I just crank up some tunes, play them very loud, and then open up Keybr, so keybr.com, which is sort of the typing training thing. And I just start typing super fast for the extent of just one song, right? And I could say,
I assume this is like an 80s style hero montage song.
No, usually it's just some weird stuff. And my wife's like,
Eye of the Tiger.
My wife's like, why are you listening to sea shanties so loud? At
because I'm typing. Butterscotch Shenanigans. Hey, everybody. Welcome to episode 254 of Coffee with Butterscotch, the game dev comedy podcast, Butterscotch Shenanigans. I'm Seth, and I'm the games programmer.
I'm Adam, and I'm the kitten wrangler.
I'm Sam.
And this is a show where we talk about life, business, and working in the games industry. Today is April 12th, 20 Blend Day. Before we get started, we have a warning. There's going to be some swears in this show.
Just all up in it.
All up in there. We'd also like to thank our supporters over at moneygrab.bscotch.net. We grabbed their money. We grabbed a couple of new folks' money.
There's nothing like a fresh wallet.
Fresh wallets.
Actually, fresh wallets smell great.
They do.
You get that fresh, like the leather ones, I guess.
I was going
to
say,
but now you have to murder animals, and now that's not really good. So I guess
I was thinking about the first wallet I had, which was like a Velcro wallet. You know, that was like a weird, it was like that sweatpants material.
Where I remember that.
You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah. And the windbreaker wallets.
Yes, it's a windbreaker material. And then you
have you guys seen those carbon fiber wallets?
No.
It's legit. It's like made of two carbon fiber plates that are about the size of a credit card. And then it has like a strap inside that kind of holds them together. And every time I see these, I'm like, what?
Yeah, why?
Then? Why?
I think
so. You can only put it in your front pocket because, of course, if it's in your back pocket and you sit on it, then now you break your ass on your on your own wallet.
Yeah, you don't want to be putting something harder than your body in your back pocket. You know what I mean?
But then you do have a bulletproof ass.
That's true.
Is a thing we can all only dream of.
You know? Here in the U.S. is, I mean, that's just good travel.
There are bullets everywhere. Yeah.
Flying around like birds. It's crazy.
Yeah.
It's migratory season for bullets.
So we got new donations from Preston, who says, Sam, thank you for discussing ADHD on the show. I would have never asked my doctor if it wasn't for you sharing your experience.
Oh, dang.
My production has skyrocketed, and it is amazing what quality of life improvements can do. Here's my appreciation in the form of caffeine and sugar.
Excellent. Thank you for paying me. I appreciate it.
Thank you for buying us some coffee, Preston. We also got a coffee from Intuition, who then said, fuck coffee. Never mind. Bake yourselves some sweet cake to celebrate the incoming launch. So I guess
– is that giving us work to do? Is that what's happening?
Well, first he tried to just send us outside. I mean
– yeah, he's sending us out – he's sending us out into the pandemic to bake some – to get some cake ingredients. Really try to sabotage the launch here. I think what's happening is probably Intuition, as we all know, is one of our top speedrunners in Levelhead.
Yeah.
He's got a lot of shoes. You know,
he doesn't want people to take him away.
It's a big conflict of interest here. I see it.
Once the game comes out and we've got 10,000 levels coming out a day – he's not going to be able to keep up.
Yeah, because I think he has like the top score on what, every level currently or something damn close to that?
No, he's got a lot. I know Usu also has a lot.
Yes, that's true.
We've got a few folks at the top who are really neck and neck. But
and Usu, you know, used to be able to do it under the radar because his notifications weren't working for like
– he'd steal shoes and nobody knew. Yeah. So he just hoarded them. So clearly Intuition's trying to sabotage this whole thing. Well, it's not going to happen.
Nope, not on our watch.
We're going to buy coffee with it.
We're going to buy coffee. But you can't stop us.
We're going to order coffee to be delivered to our houses.
Yeah.
Yeah.
to stay COVID safe.
We'd also like to thank our recurring supporters whose money we grab just all the time.
Thank you.
Month by month. Thank you very much. All right. Let's talk about Adam's bidet.
Oh, bidet Watch 2020.
We talked about this. It must have been the last podcast episode. Yep. That does feel – we always joke about how time moves weird. But man, is it –
man, is it moving weird
right now.
I think time is standing still and we're just moving through it weirdly. You know what I mean?
Sure, yeah. That sounds
– it's not, it's just hanging out.
It's like all time relativity, you know?
Time is a pool. Time is a pool of viscous liquid and we're sort of slurping on through.
Slurping.
Yep. It's like a honey pool. But yeah, so last week we talked about, hey, there's no more toilet paper, which also we did have to finally go out and get groceries out in the real world, my wife and I, just a few days ago.
Did you find TP?
And the only – everything was fully stocked, stocked to the brim. The only thing that was not was toilet paper. So y'all fucking maniacs out there.
Why?
The least important thing of all the grocery items. But anyway, so then we talked about last week how I've got this bidet. Talked about it, I think, a year ago for the first time when I first bought it and never plugged it in. And I was like, at this point, we're going to be running out of toilet paper because all these people keep buying all of it for no reason. So I guess this is the time, under the belief that a bidet would reduce toilet paper requirements. So finally, last weekend, last Sunday, I buckled my pants.
Did you buckle them off?
Unbuckled them, you know, so that in the future I could unbuckle them, right? Yeah. And get more value out of that.
Yeah.
So I finally plugged it all in. Took like, I don't know, hour or so to install. I ended up not being able to hook up the one that I got has a cold and a hot water going into it.
Yeah.
So you have to plug it. You have to use one. You have to get hot water from your sink and then cold water from like the toilet input, you know. But then it turned out that because of how my cold water was hooked up, I couldn't actually plug in the cold side. But then I thought, I don't want cold water on my butthole. Yeah,
you only want hot.
Yeah, this seems fine. So I just didn't hook it up and figured I'd just see if that was fine.
It's a brave move. If you don't know the temperature of that water coming out.
It's coming from the sink, and the sink never burns my hands, you know. So I figured,
but does it burn your butt?
Yeah, does it burn your butt?
That was the question.
Sensitive part.
So it all came out fine. Although if you don't turn on the sink, so that the bidet has sort of two modes. It's a very simple one. So one is you turn the nozzle one way and it just kind of runs water down itself so that it can clean itself. That's clean in quotes because it's just dropping some, you know, water, right?
Right.
When you're trying to clean, it's a rinse. It's a gentle rinse. So, and the other mode is it, you know, squirts you in the butthole, right? So,
yeah.
If you're seated in the right position. Otherwise, it squirts you in some other place.
How do you know how to sit correctly?
You gotta learn by doing. This is the whole thing about bidets. Is you gotta practice, and practice makes perfect, you know? So what I've already learned.
It sure does.
So I've been using it, and I've learned a few lessons. So these are my
all right, give us some Adam's bidet tips.
I mean, there's never been a time where these tips are more valuable.
They're very valuable
than
right
literally
now.
Today.
You know, the world is moving away from handshakes and toward bidets.
So tip number one. While it is fine to be squirted in the butthole with cold water, it is not the best. If you want to wake up real fast, that will do it. So if you need to kick off your morning with just like a refreshing, startling jolt, don't even need coffee at all. So if you're trying to kick coffee, go with cold water and bidet. That'll do it.
Yep.
If you don't want that to happen and you do have a hot water hookup to your bidet, never forget that there's cold water in like the – you know, the 12 or 24 or whatever inches of tiny pipe that's leading up to it.
Right.
Because that means
sitting there all night, that means you got 12 inches of cold water that's coming first. So you can use the rinse thing because it's all the same water, right? So you can use the rinse side just to like run it clear to get your hotness.
Clear those pipes.
So I literally turn on the sink first onto hot until the sink is hot and I turn that off. Mm. And then I like run the rinse mode for like 10 seconds so that it, what's left in the pipe comes out on that side. And then you're ready. Just a pure, straight, hot shot of water right into your bum.
Because you could also, I mean, I feel like the hot cold could also be used almost like they do in, you know, spas and stuff, where like you want a sauna for a while, an ice bath.
Yep.
You know, maybe it's very soothing on the back.
If you want to get it even colder, you would need to add sort of a secondary step where there's an ice bath that the water goes through. So I haven't done that because I'm really enjoying the hot water mode. but somebody could try such a thing, definitely. So that's tip number one is that. So tip number two is it's all about positioning. I have learned that I normally sit further forward than bidets expect. But I don't know if that's because I don't know if that's because like I just sit more forward than I'm supposed to. Because
you're ready to just leave. You're like, I need to get out of here.
Yeah, exactly. I'm like,
You're ready to go. You're in America.
Yeah.
Things take your time back fast here? For no reason.
Exactly. So I learned. So basically, you can use the positioning of the jet because you know where it's supposed to hit, right? So you use that position to find out where you're normally supposed to sit on a toilet. So it's actually very educational.
You'll
discover a thing that you've done wrong your entire life, basically.
So I learned the other day that apparently a large fraction of people turn the shower on while they are in the shower. And there's like a faction of people who claim they're like, I hate showering in the morning because like it's just so cold at first, you know. And then other people were like,
why don't you warm the water up first?
What are you talking about? Turn the water on, let it warm up, and then get in. And that this is like a third of the population just hasn't.
This is dots. To me, this is the valuable lesson from the bidet, which is if you Google, how do you properly use a bidet to make sure you get a clean bum hole with, mm-hmm. you know, minimum toilet paper use and like having only a pleasant time?
That's a long Google search.
You would. I filtered it down after the initial search, but okay. you'll be impressed to discover that there is no one correct known way to use a bidet.
Oh,
so this
it's more of an art than a science.
You probably don't want to use it as a drinking fountain, though, right?
Yep.
That is probably the wrong way to do it. I think that's fair.
The wrong way.
To clarify, there's definitely a wrong way.
You definitely could, because if you were not sitting down when that water came up, yeah, there's now a water fountain.
How far? There are lots of right ways to use it, and one very wrong.
But that's the thing, is I don't think there's really like lots of right ways. So, because I think about this example with like the shower and people not turning it on, and then like not even knowing there was a thing you could do. And every once in a while, if you're like on Reddit, somebody will ask some question and be like, I was talking to my spouse or my friend or my roommate or whatever.
Yeah.
And they said, and for some reason we got on this topic and they said that they wipe standing up and I wipe standing down. And I couldn't even imagine a universe in which like a person would do it the other way. Right.
Mm. Yep.
And neither party can. There's like a million things like this. So it is wild that there are all these things that are just like, we all do this every day. We all do this every day.
But privately.
Privately.
And you don't want to talk about it. You know.
And we don't talk about it. And despite the fact that there's like equipment designed for this purpose that's standardized, like a toilet is a standardized thing. Toilet paper is a standardized thing.
And we're all pretty much roughly shaped the same.
We're all shaped basically the same.
And you don't have that many people walking around with four legs and stuff.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then for some reason, we don't do things the same way. Like it seems like there should be a correct way to do it because things were designed around what is presumably the correct way to do it.
But the designs of a toilet and even toilet paper don't imply a particular usage.
No, they don't. That's but also the then we don't – so we all have to actually learn – we all have to learn ourselves through like whatever our parents think is the way things are supposed mm-hmm. to work and then whatever they manage to teach us because everyone's being so like squirrely and private about all this stuff. So that the end result is that the most fundamentally like – human and boring things in the universe, like taking a dump.
No one knows how to do properly.
No one is doing.
Or I guess there's no agreed.
There's no agreed upon way to do it.
So I watched the show called 100 Humans on Netflix. Which
is that good?
It's kind of dumb. It's almost Mythbustersy, but not quite as charismatic nor as fun.
Good.
And so, but basically, what I did is I ended up just sort of speeding to the various results sections, and they actually do a whole bit. On exactly this, on exactly the questions of how people use the toilet. So does the toilet paper roll go over or under? And then they get percentages based on this like really diverse 100-person pool. And then the question of which direction do you wipe? Front
yeah,
to back,
right?
Back to front. And and then they come out with like the breakdown of how everybody behaves, all this stuff. It is absolutely fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. But I think it's like –
because for each one of these, one of them has to be the better answer, right?
Well, just maybe.
Like,
maybe.
Just like from a – because things are physically happening when you do these things, right? So like back to front versus front to back, there has to be a good reason, like a really good reason to choose one over the other. Mm-hmm. And of course, we all think that we're doing it the right way, but like
– But are we?
I don't know. So that to me, that was kind of really the fundamental takeaway, which is – so number one, a bidet is a pretty pleasant experience kind of out of the box. Because then you just have like a warm, more fresh than usual bum, right?
Yeah.
But the main problem is that it's not obvious how exactly you're supposed to use it. And so the sort of the barrier to entry is weirdly high. Because I was like Googling. I was like, okay, how do I use this thing now that I've plugged it in, right? And everyone's
you
like,
didn't just well, sit on it and give it a go.
Yeah, basically you sit on it and give it a go. But then the question is like, how long do you sit there? Because like you got to find out, you know, right?
So how does this work? Is there like a switch? You flick a switch and then it like
there's
starts
a,
shooting.
There's like a little nozzle knob, so you just turn it up and it just increases. Like the pressure at just on is like
It's a hand crank. You just got to really go for it.
So you turn it on, and then you have to manually turn it off, or is it like a timed?
Situation? You just turn it on, turn it back off. But I mean, depending on if you're using like a fancy one, like a fancy Japanese one or something, then there's all kinds of stuff going on there. You know, because when my wife and I went to Taiwan, we got to use one of those for the first time. And that was where we got to have the experience of like it blow dries you, you know. It's like so then you can get those hot air coming in and the whole deal.
Those are the ones where the toilet like it does your taxes and it knows your deepest
feeds your pets. And,
yeah, they've got it figured out. Awesome. One day, maybe we'll get there.
I'm not 100% sure I'm using this thing correctly, but it is still a better experience than not using it. But it's not to the point yet where I'm just like. I'm nowhere near a rabid advocate for this that I've heard some people be, which means either I'm still not doing it the way that they're doing it yet, or that there's just some variation in the pleasantness of the experience.
You know? I just like how 2020 for Adam has been all about strapping jets to things. You know,
yep.
you got a jet on your bed.
Yeah.
And you got a jet on your toilet.
But this is the thing. It's important though, right? Because we have these fundamental human experiences like sleeping and – vacating our guts, right? Mm-hmm. These things that we're doing every day and how the quality of those experiences is really important. You know?
It's going to creep into everything. You know?
Yeah, it creeps into everything. It just ruins it ruins like at least 30 minutes of your day, but potentially your whole day, especially if you're having trouble going, you can't find a bathroom, like all this stuff, right? We have all these fundamental things that we just kind of invest in.
We just kind of privately suffer.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we'll spend $1,000 on a device that we stare at for 8 hours a day that gives us horrible back pain, right? But we won't spend $500 adding air conditioning to our bed, you know, to improve the quality of our sleep literally every night for the rest of our lives. And now I have to say, now having had the bed jet, since my cat was sick during the week, and so I slept on the couch to like give her some additional human time. Since normally we can't sleep with the cats because my wife's allergic. So I slept on the couch. And I had no bed jet.
Mm-hmm.
And oh my God, my temperature regulation is just a fucking nightmare. I could not sleep at all. And I was like, this is how it used to be. Just
how did
night.
I live like this?
How did I live like this? So
invest in yourself,
right? Invest in the gross basic human necessities like going to the bathroom, sleeping.
And sleeping
isn't gross, I guess. Actually, it's pretty gross. You wake up, you're like, your eyes are full of crusty stuff, you know?
I hate that.
You've been hallucinating.
The worst is like you get through the day and you look in the mirror and you're like, there's a diamond of sleep goo encrusted upon my eyelid that no one has said anything. I've been carrying around this rock on my face. But no one said that.
Disturbing. Yeah, speaking of getting up in the morning.
You have to shower the moment you wake up, you know? Like, it's wild. Mm-hmm.
Wow. Sam, you wanted to talk about something called a turbo day start.
Well, so I've just been, you know, we're kind of like Adam, you know, we're at home now a lot. So just kind of been noodling about how to improve my home life, my situation. I used to have a pretty rigorous, like, couple of things I would forcibly do in the mornings before heading into work. And then this is like years ago. And then as I kind of gotten into a better swing with work stuff, I would just sort of wake up, get ready, head into the office. And that was about the extent of it. So now that we're at home, of course, there's no heading into the office. So there's this free time vacuum that's popped up. And so I thought to myself, how could I make this morning just a little more fun? Yeah, a little more mling. And so what I do now, here's what I do. Okay. I set up my yoga mat next to my bed a while ago. I think we talked about the podcast as far as, you know, structure, assisting with stretching and stuff. So I wake up in the morning, just sort of like flop over there and then do some push-ups, do some squats, and then sort of like roll around a little bit, like literally just sort of like wiggling around.
Do you have a ramp or something on the side of your bed so you can just kind of like?
I wish I could just like a hill. I wish. Oh my God, that'd just be amazing.
Wake up, roll down onto your yoga mat, and you're ready to go.
I think you wake up a lot faster if you fall from a height, though.
That's true. Ideally, you're just dropped directly onto the yoga mat.
Yeah, so I think that ramp kind of works against the getting.
And then
ready
a bidet. That's true. Then a bidet snipes you from a.
as you're rolling, you get some sort of like butt tracking software.
Yeah, so I do, and this is not a lot. It's literally like 5 to 10 push-ups and squats, right? So it's just I'm just like I want to wake up my body, right? And then get up, go for a walk now, with my wife, usually just like 3 or 4 blocks, sort of moving the limbs. And then come back in, it's still not even work time yet. It's like maybe 8:40. I wake up at like 8 on the dot. And so I got 20 minutes. So instead of doing like a lot of planning stuff, whatever else, I just crank up some tunes, play them very loud, and then open up Keybr. So keybr.com, which is sort of the typing training thing.
You just rock out to speed typing. And I just start
typing super fucking fast for the extent of just one song, right? And I could say—
I assume this is like an 80s style hero montage song.
No, usually it's just some weird stuff. And my wife's like—
Eye of the Tiger.
My wife's like, why are you listening to sea shanties so loud at—
You're like, because I'm typing.
And so I just type, and it's literally like, again, it's like 3 minutes. But this combination of these, like that minute of sort of just doing some push-ups and stuff, and then this minute or two of extremely fast typing plus listening to rock and music before the workday starts, for some reason, is just like—
It starts your day with momentum.
Yeah, I just feel like I've arrived, you know, by 9 o'clock. It's kind of awesome. So I wanted to share that if anybody's looking for kind of, you know, pro methods to make your morning quarantine a little more exciting. There you go.
Now, see, my ideal morning is kind of the opposite. You remember Wallace and Gromit?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Where he had a series of elaborate machines.
That's kind of flung him out of bed.
Yeah. He's basically
still asleep.
He's just sleeping the whole time, but he's brushing his teeth. He's putting pants on. He's shaving. You know, he's getting his toast made. And then he just wakes up at the breakfast table ready for the day.
That's also shit. How I prefer my
that
morning.
That was dope. Yep. That was dope. That's some good advice. So flop out of bed directly onto the floor, get sniped in the butt with a bidet turret,
do
a bunch of push-ups, sit-ups, go for a walk, and then do some speed keyboarding.
Yep, to loud music.
Then you're ready to go. All right, let's talk about our studio.
Yeah.
Let's talk about quarterly review, which we did. It's been a quarter,
it 3 months. It has been.
And this was a big one because we're coming up on a launch. A lot of things have happened in the past few months. So we actually had to take 2 whole freaking days to unpack everything, which it was a lot. It was actually after the first day, I just laid on the ground for 20 minutes. I couldn't talk for a whole day. It was like a punch in the brain.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the interesting things that came out of this, which is something that we have talked about internally in the past, and I think I mentioned in my GDC talk, but is this idea of structure as culture. And this is something that I think you see in institutions and organizations all over the place, is there's something that they want people to do, right? Like at school, the teachers want the students to behave a certain way. Or if you're at your workplace and your boss or whatever says like, we'd really like to see more of this from everybody, right? But one thing that we are firm believers in as game developers is that people primarily respond to what's happening around them. They don't resist what's happening around them, right? And so when we talk to people about like their personal productivity, one of the things we often hone in on is well, what's your house like? Or what's your living space like? What's your workspace like? These idea of like starting your day in a certain way in order to give yourself the momentum, you know, those kinds of things. And so so one of the things that we always hone in these quarterly meetings is like, what structures do we have in place in the studio in terms of our processes or our tools or the timing of things, and how do those structures make people act?
Yes.
Right. As opposed to flipping around and saying like, how are people doing this? How are people doing that? And do we like that? And if we don't like it, we should tell them to be different, which
doesn't make any sense.
It just genuinely, it doesn't work. Sam, I think you maybe had some thoughts on this.
Yeah, well, I think it's one of those things that we've been exploring more in the past, basically the past year since doing DevOps stuff and sort of stumbling into this as a thing and recognizing that as much as possible, you know, if you want a change to happen for yourself as well as like in a company, change management is a thing people talk about a lot, right? how difficult it is to get a group of people who are currently doing this thing to be doing that thing. And I think a way to think about this,
it's often framed in terms of leadership. You know, like you gotta inspire people and motivate them.
And this is what we tried to do in our first round of hiring, is we thought it was all about that. And
all the books we read and everything was just like motivation and leadership.
Yeah, of course, while recognizing that, you know, if we get home at the end of the day and it's been a hard day, that we're also the exact same people who've been, you know, would eat a chocolate bar or like dig into some candy or something if it was home. And that they're not putting together the fact that that the structural elements of how you've designed your business and how it runs, or even your family life, your home life, your personal stuff, is at the end of the day what ends up making the culture that you want actually appear.
That's what makes you who you are.
Yeah. And so, we've just been sort of, I think, ferreting out more and more about how this works and getting a little more intense about it. And it does a lot of interesting things. I think the most important one is that it takes pressure off in a weird way from both on the leadership side as well as on the employee side, because it's no longer the case that you as an employee have to remember something like the 12 values of the company and keep them in mind at all times and try to, you know, make sure you're acting in accordance with them all the time. If it's the case that the structures that you're operating in just make it like we talked about.
The structures are built around those values.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And so you think about these things in the same way that you would design a tool or you would design something in a video game, which is every structure has certain affordances to it. Certain things that it suggests you should do.
Or create certain incentives.
Yep. Or create certain incentives. And so, you know, now that we're working remote from home, that was one of those big struggles we had, which was like, how do we set up our office such that we still get a lot of that interesting collaboration time? It's very easy. There's not like a lot of gristle in moving between, working on something and popping in to ask someone a question about something. And that structure that we came up with of the VoIP offices, where everyone has their office and you can just pop in and say, hey, has 100% made it possible for us to replicate that in studio culture. Like you would actually call that a culture, right? Which is that, people work really hard solo. And then they also, it's a free environment where you can pop in and it's okay to like interrupt someone essentially, right? To
collaborate on things.
And so I think just really focusing on that and recognizing that what it does at the end of the day is it makes it so that people, it's much easier for people to do both what they want to do and also what they believe they should be doing. And that's kind of the extent of it, right? We've talked about this with our own personal projects, you know, coming home, work from home and doing like a focus mate session to try to make sure you do the thing that you want to do. We've talked about with regard to ADHD, sort of the problem with having ADHD is not being able to do what you want to do. And you cure a lot of those things by structure first. And then of course, you know, in the case of someone with ADHD, maybe medication later, but the structures are kind of the things that end up making a big difference for all these.
Yeah. And I think if you're a manager at a workplace or something like that, and you keep getting the same outcomes for something that you don't want. So like, let's say you have a certain policy in place that like your employees are supposed to do this thing. And like a fourth of the time, it always comes out this other way or something, right? Like there's always this kind of like error or problem in the process or something.
Yeah. The question, because it may be the people, but the question you should first ask is it the structure?
Yes. 100%. Because
because if your process requires that all of your people be perfect, then it's a bad process because people aren't perfect.
Yeah, so an easy example of forgiveness mechanics, you know,
essentially. It's an easy example of this. What we're dealing with now is that with Levelhead being on so many platforms, we're basically tracking the release candidates for the game, basically the final versions of the game, as they are on these seven platforms, what state they're in, which version is in the testing phase versus actually rolled out, et cetera, et cetera. And we needed a way to track this. So of course, you know, do the first MVP thing, which is make a little spreadsheet inside of our Notion, keep track of it. And the difficulty of actually keeping it up to date, though, because it's purely manual, is
which means you have to remember. You make a release candidate, you got to go to the spreadsheet and update it, which is terrible. It's a terrible process.
and that's one of those things that ideally we move into a place where something like that is actually fully automated, so that it's not a thing people have to remember to do because it simply is done by virtue of
it's built into some, even if it's built into some manual process, but in such a way that keeping it up to date is like an obvious next step, right? So that you do it, because it's when it's so thoroughly decoupled from what you need to be, from what your actual like day to day is, otherwise can't. I think other good examples of this for code are saying like, if you want to make sure that everybody's code is getting looked at, building in a required peer review step, which you can do with all the tools that are available, like GitHub and so on, via pull request, where you can basically just say that nothing is allowed to actually go into the final code until at least two people have looked at it, right? Yep. And that can be built actually just basically structurally into the system. So there's a whole bunch of stuff you can do like that.
Well, importantly with that.
Or even test-driven development, right? Yeah. All of these things are built around that.
Well, because I think the important thing about what it is it recognizes that people are people, right? And then it says, we're not going to have a structure that allows you to make a mistake at scale by pushing broken code into the project, right? It provides the ability for people to actually feel safer in terms of like what the work is that they're producing, right? Because you know that you're not going to be able to do something like blow up the entirety of
it removes an enormous amount of task switching, right? Because if a lot of what you have to do is remember all of the things that you're supposed to do,
yes,
then it makes it harder to do everything, and it makes it very likely that things are going to fall apart.
But also think about what this. Because I think it's so interesting to me how this like is such a pure parallel between like what we do as designers and the real world, which is like if our players are doing something in one of our games and we're like, man, I wish they wouldn't do that. That is not their problem. That's our problem, because we have made the system that they are operating in, and the system either doesn't prevent them from doing a certain thing. Or it even might encourage them to do the wrong thing, or there's just not enough information, so they don't know what they're supposed to do. And if you kind of mirror this over to real world institutions like school, which I think is such a wild place, because the blame for any kind of problem always just lands on the student, right? Like the student gets the detention, the student gets expelled, the student gets the F. You know, whatever, and you just don't really see large scale structural overhauls of saying like, well, you know, 20% of our people aren't graduating or whatever. Mm-hmm. Why would that be the case? And let's make some fundamental changes to what we are doing, to make that happen. And you do see this in some levels, but I don't know. It's rare that the blame entirely lands on the person, and really they're just responding to what's happening in the in the structure.
Yeah.
So that's kind of an interesting takeaway. So we also did some what we call pre-mortem/scenario planning stuff, which we could talk about a little bit, and then we can talk about sort of what's coming next for Levelhead. So our idea with scenario planning and pre-mortems is basically. We don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
So instead of making a projection and saying like, here's our estimated revenue.
My favorite thing is looking at people's projections for their product launches. It's always a hockey stick curve. And I'm like, this literally never happens.
There's always based on the way these other games performed over the past 3 years and based on this and based on that, we think we're going to land here. And it's always wrong. It's just always wrong. So we don't do those things. Instead, we just lay out brackets or tiers of outcomes, which have meaningful differences for us. So for us, these things just amount to like, if we get this many players, will we do anything differently than if we get 3 times that many players or 10 times that many players?
And then what would those things be at those various points, right?
Yeah. And so that we found to be the most sort of useful way of thinking about things, because it doesn't make any assumptions. Mm-hmm. It's like what we know is what we can do. And then the future has a range of possible outcomes, which are completely unknown.
Yeah, if you know what you're going to do at each outcome, then – you know what to plan for. Because if one of those outcomes that is reasonably likely is something bad, then you can start planning for now. You know, planning for it now, figure out what are you going to do now while things aren't bad.
And in fact, that's actually what a pre-mortem is for, right? A pre-mortem is you literally ask the question, what are all the ways that this will fail? And so basically you start with the assumption that it failed. And then you say, how did that happen?
Yeah. And what's then, our worst case scenario and how do we manage that?
Yep. And then scenario planning is basically sort of the other part of it, which is, okay, once this is out, given its various success levels, then what are we doing at each kind of tier, right? And so we found this helped a ton with Crashlands back in the day. And we always do this a few weeks before launch because things like launch is such a weird time and there's a lot of fires that you don't want to be doing this sort of slow, high-level thinking at that.
You want to be able to live in the moment. You want to be able to like do interviews. You want to like pop into Twitch streams and chat with streamers.
Enjoy the fact that you just did a massive human achievement, basically, by launching a game, right?
Yeah. So that's a pretty useful thing to do. So anybody who has like a big question mark coming in your future, you know, it could be a game launch or anything. Do this thing, you know, do this like. Assume that it went wrong and then talk and then like write out all the ways you think that might have happened and then try to build up some resilience to those things.
Well, this is even true for our current global situation with COVID, right? Is what if you're stuck in the same situation we're stuck in now, but for the next 3 months, the next 6 months, the next year?
Yeah.
What if we actually do get out of this? What happens? Because things won't go back to normal, right? They'll just go back to a less restrictive state of some sort. So what is that going to look like and how long is that going to go? There's no way to know that at all. So what you can do is some scenario planning where you can look at your worst case scenarios, your best case scenarios, and try to figure out what would you do if each of those different things happened? Because if you know that, even if some of those things are still bad, because sometimes there is no good way, right? But if you know exactly what those are, that reduces one of the key parts of anxiety, which is just the complete unknown. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you know what the situations are going to look like and you can plan or at least just know, then you're in a much better spot.
Yeah. And these can be a little stressful to grapple with at that initial outset. Yeah, but I honestly, like if you give this something like this a try, there are very few things that I would like to give guarantees on as far as like their effects. But I feel like doing something like some scenario planning or a pre-mortem of an upcoming thing you got going on, they always, always make you feel so much better about what the thing is, because you get that degree of agency back, right? Where you say, okay, you know what? Yes, things might be going to shit, but I have
some control out of it.
Yeah, a little bit of control.
You know exactly how they're going to shit and what you're going to do about it,
which is a big difference. It's a very big difference.
It is. It takes, like Adam was saying, it's all about the unknown, where it goes from you saying like, oh my god, what am I going to do if blah.
Mm-hmm.
And then ending the thought there and saying, here's what I'm going to do if that happens. And now you, like you said, you have this feeling of agency or control, which is good. So as far as level head stuff goes, we are coming up on the launch. We're like two-ish weeks out by the time this podcast airs, which is
wild.
Which is, I'm pretty excited.
It is very soon.
So we are pretty much ready to go on all the platforms. Just one final little thing.
We also slung traditional Chinese in there.
Oh yeah, we got traditional Chinese now. Yeah,
we just snuck that in there, just because.
Just casual. Just snuck in one whole extra language.
Have we gotten that through? Have we gotten that through all the certs?
I think
we
got through Xbox. That's the final things. Yep, it's through Xbox. Switch is in progress. So we should
Xbox, Google Play. Yeah, we're good.
There's no reason to think that that would cause a delay. The only delay would actually be just because it takes a while to get through the cert process.
Correct.
And what we have been seeing too is that things are getting a little more slow from all of our sort of platform partners. Because everything is kind of slowing down a bit. But
yeah, so it's good that we gave ourselves a month before the launch to submit things and get everything finalized, because launching something on this scale is just not up to us, right? When it comes to, I think only Steam is the one where we can just like put it on there. And
that's it. Nobody cares.
There's no third party coming and being like, let me check this out.
But importantly, actually, they did for your first ever launch. They do a quick check on it, right? And you can get stuff like if you messed up your foil badges for – like that's what happened to us in Crashlands actually. We delayed by or messed us up for a day or two trying to get our badges figured out for Steam. But if coming out of early access, we literally just – we're just going to hit a button. That's it.
So because all of these things have human people involved checking them out and vetting things, then just because of the worldwide situation, things are taking a while. And so far, we have no reason to think that we're going to miss anything.
Yeah.
But of course,
track.
If that does happen, we will oh, begin yeah, screaming.
Yep.
So that's happening. And then we've also been talking about what our post-launch plan is in terms of what's development going to look like, in terms of content delivery, what kinds of content are we going to make? And we've been reflecting on what we've been doing for the past few months, where we've been like developing the tutorial, making lots of interface updates and new user experience improvements. And our goal post-launch is to try to open up the gameplay more, mm-hmm. which is basically just come up with as many new interesting items as possible to be able to allow players to do just even wilder and more ridiculous things.
Yeah, basically start trying
to – and even some fundamental changes to game systems and mechanics. So not changes as in like they don't behave the same anymore, but additions, right? But that mm-hmm. – that fundamentally change aspects of how you think about it as a kind of game.
Yeah. So yeah. The major goal with that is just to continue opening up the content. The really nice thing about Levelhead is that, you know, every additional piece we add just keeps on it's
combinatorial.
Yeah, it ramps up the complexity a massive amount. So we don't have that marginal loss issue like in games we did with Crashlands, where every new recipe was just kind of like another one versus changing everything
it once. And
yeah. And so that's really exciting, but I think we will be taking a much slower pace in terms of actually rolling those out. And a lot of that has to do with now that we're
marketing.
Yeah. It's a lot of it actually has to do, as far as timing, it has to do with marketing, which is, it doesn't make sense to just every single week be pumping out new stuff at all, even if we wanted to. But with all the platforms, we want to be able to do, you know, simultaneous release of the patches and stuff. And so it'll be a much slower process as far as getting this first wave of new content out. We also have
every release has to sim ship, which makes the cost of every release really, really high.
Yeah.
And there's no point in releasing something if you don't market it. And yes. So that also makes that makes it even higher by a lot. And then if you do a successful marketing campaign 1 week and then 2 weeks later do another one.
Yeah.
You're getting some diminishing returns really rapidly.
Though. Definitely. So,
well, we actually found something really interesting back. I don't know if you remember this, Sam, but in the middle of Crashlands development, we did literally every Monday, we made a whole game and launched it.
Oh, yeah.
And we did that for 5 weeks.
Yeah.
So that's where Roid Rage came from. That's where Flop Rocket came from. Yeah. We had a couple of those like Freeway Mutant,
Tupidemic,
which is pretty.
Burger Defense.
Mm-hmm. Burger Defense.
Extreme Burger Defense. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, and Extreme Sloth. No, Sloth Cycling was different there. So what we found was something really interesting, which was like we made Roid Rage was the first one. We made it in a day and put it up. And there were actually a bunch of articles and stuff on mobile gaming sites. And they're like, Butterscotch Shinig has just made this game in 8 hours and released it. And it's good.
Yep.
go check it out. Yeah. And it got, I think it got like 30 or 40,000 downloads in the first week. And
it did great. Actually, made us some money. We were like, what?
Yeah. And then the next week, we're like, we're doing it again. Because basically our strategy was, we were like, we're going to put out a game every Monday and then we'll resume development on Crashlands Tuesday through Friday, which is a fucking wild thing to do.
And ignores the entirety of the reality of what it means to successfully launch a commercial title.
Well, right? So that's what happened with all the rest of them, which is after the first one, because the first one was news because we hadn't done anything in a while. And then all the rest of them, actually, no one gave a shit about. No one covered them.
So in week two, we put it out and it's like, oh, okay, sure. I guess like they made another one in 8 more hours. And then the next week, people are like, again? I mean, come on, guys.
So the time between launch and the first update will be a while. And a big part of that too is we have, as we talked about, launch has consumed a tremendous amount of resources in just getting everything ready for it and also a tremendous amount of marketing resources. And we've been able to identify, because of this, a bunch of basically these other production issues that we just have or have had. There are problems with our art pipeline that have existed
still unresolved
for at least a year. They're still unresolved.
There are problems with every pipeline.
Every single pipeline has some issues. And so we have some significant work to do to get everything singing again, basically. And it's not a ton. It's just enough that there's a lot of work to do to kind of get all
this. We need to be able to slow stuff down a bit so that we can – be prepared for finishing up all the updates to Levelhead and for working on the next title.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of like in the Sonic games when he curls into a ball and then like smoke starts coming out of the back before he blasts forward. It's like that.
Yeah, that's what we need.
It's just that kind 100% of a move. Yeah. So that's kind of where things are at with the studio, with Levelhead and everything. Launch is coming. So be sure to get onto bscotch.net get your Rumpus account set up.
Yeah, hook up to every account in the universe.
Yeah, in there you can link accounts like your Apple ID, your Xbox account,
Nintendo your Twitch account, your Epic everything. Account.
Bring it all in, link it all under one Rumpus account.
Also, we don't get any of your info, by the way, because we don't give a shit.
We get your email address sometimes.
Yeah. But we don't. Yeah, we're not like mining your data and stuff. Nope. It's just for you to be able to easily connect all your stuff on the platforms.
Yeah. So that way, on day one, you know, you can play it on your Xbox, pick up your iPhone, exactly pick up where you left off, then switch over to Steam and play around on there for a while. Work on the same level if you want. Mm-hmm.
Assuming you buy it on all of those places, which you definitely should do.
Which, of course, you will. all right. So let's get on to some questions. These questions come from our listeners over at podcast.bscotch.net. First question is from Seven Cho, who we haven't heard from in a while.
That's true. It has been a while.
Who says, what is your self-quarantine game of choice?
Ooh.
Good question.
I've got an easy answer right now, which is I haven't been able to take any time to play any damn games because I've been cat wrangling and then trying to put in extra hours to get all the server infrastructure ready for launch. Mm-hmm. So I don't have one, but I've been wanting to play Terraria. So I guess that would be mine.
I have. Yeah,
that's your dream game. That's my dream of choice.
I only have a very anxious dog, so I've been able to play Terraria. And I did. I booted it up with the Calamity mod and the Anti-Aris mod, which both add a ton of weapons and all sorts of stuff. And then for some reason, I decided to play it on expert mode, even though both of those and like some and
sick
some other boss rush sort of mode that makes all the bosses harder. So I am struggling deeply. I forgot what happened to me in Terraria the first time, which is the reason I ended up playing it for a long time the first time was actually because I spent 2 hours reading the wiki and making a plan on a post-it note and then like on multiple post-it notes about like what things to go do. Yeah. And so the first day or two I was playing, I was like, I'm not seeing any of this new content because I don't know where it is. I don't know how to access it. Terraria, of course, completely opaque. So I have no idea where to get these new weapons and stuff. And so I was like, what? And I was having a bad time. And the second night, I literally spent an hour and a half. I was like, Dad, I'm gonna go game. She's like, okay. And then about bedtime, she's like, are you even playing? And I was like, I have 40 tabs open of the very thing. Because now I have the Terraria wiki, I have the Calamity mod wiki, and the Anti-Aris
It wiki. Sounds like playing Terraria is a lot like playing EVE Online.
Kind of.
You're like, I'm gonna go play some Terraria. And then you've got fucking Excel open, and you're on a conference call with a bunch of other people coming up with a plan and shit.
But I made tremendous progress and started having a lot of fun once I did that. But then I hit this boss wall where I'm just getting murdered, and I can't figure it out.
When you say boss wall, do you mean the wall of flesh?
Not the actual boss wall. No. This is a different one. Boss wall. I took out one of the bosses, and then the one I'm supposed to be killing next is just ripping my face off. So I'm
kind of on a sort of a related because this whole idea of like you have to pull up the wiki to figure out what to do and do all this planning and stuff, which is also true when I play Terraria. It's the same deal, just like tabs everywhere of all of the you don't know what the recipe is going to be and like you don't know what you're looking for. But this is something that's missing for a level because I've been seeing our community talk about this in the Discord about the absence of a level head wiki.
We technically have one.
But anyway, I don't want to go into the details of like what the snafu is with that. But it's just kind of an interesting idea because even with a game as simple as level head, at least in principle, right? Like it's just you just run around and jump basically, right? But there's enough depth.
There's
there.
A tremendous amount of depth to level.
Yeah, head. That it keeps it's on opening zany. Up. It's like opens up more and more, and then once you add in the whole thing that of course people can make their own levels, right? The amount of like interesting player and community generated content just to describe stuff is actually. Yeah. Is actually enormous. And so it is interesting that kind of we all have over time found games that are actually they're not that hard to interact with, but they require all this like meta level structure to actually like enjoy and really interact with effectively.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it comes into this idea of mastery, right? Which is having a game where when you learn stuff, like just the knowledge becomes a sense of power in the game, right? Like those are just – they're fun. They're so fun.
It's not just a game of skill. It's a game of
learning
knowledge.
The systems, learning the world. Very fun. Seth, what have you been
playing? I've been playing World of Warcraft just like crazy. It's been fantastic. So have I talked to you guys about this concept of a Mythic Plus?
No.
Nope.
So this is a pretty brilliant game design invention that actually came into the game in the most recent expansion. So it's been in here for two expansions now. It works like this. So World of Warcraft is an MMO. It's a fantasy game. You have different classes and roles that you can play. And they have these five-man dungeons. So you have a tank, a healer, and three damage dealers. And the dungeons have all kinds of different bosses and mechanics and interesting things to do. But it used to be the case that they were transient content. So you'd clear the dungeon, get the gear that you needed, and then that's it now. You don't have any reason to go back. And so the game had just had this perpetual problem where the developers could not produce new dungeons fast enough that were relevant for people to keep coming back to. Mm-hmm. So with the idea of a Mythic Plus is you set the dungeon to Mythic difficulty, which is the highest difficulty. And when you clear it, you get a keystone for a +2. Okay. So what that means is it levels up the dungeon to be a little bit harder.
Do things change, or is it just numbers?
Yeah. So at the start of the dungeon, at the start of the dungeon, there's a little pedestal and you can plug your keystone into there to level the dungeon up. And by default, the numbers just get bigger. But then at certain brackets, like at level like 4 and 8 and 10 and stuff, completely new mechanics get introduced
to the
dungeon. Yeah. And the mechanics, they're referred to as affixes. They're basically like mutators, but they change every week. And so one of them might be like teaming, which is there's just twice as many enemies as normal. So you have to change your whole strategy on how to navigate the dungeon. One of them is like volcanic, where randomly fire shoots out of the ground and tries to kill anybody standing at range. So now all of a sudden in every single fight, you have to be just like
packed together,
moving around all the time. And they even added this weird one, which is there's these obelisks planted throughout the dungeon, and you go into the obelisk and you're now in the shadow realm. So all of the normal enemies aren't there. And instead there are these like void shadow monsters that you fight in there. And if you don't go into the obelisks and defeat them, then they will appear while you're fighting the last boss. So you have to go in and kill them. But even crazier is when you kill them, they leave a rift that you can use to re-enter the normal world. But the rift appears wherever the boss died. So you can like go into the shadow realm, fight this boss, move it,
and then port somewhere back somewhere else.
So you can like strategically skip sections of the dungeon. So there's all these like really interesting mechanics. So
they're basically using roguelike design mechanics to
make. Yeah, exactly.
Yep. Yeah, good idea. Yeah.
So there's a lot of complexity here. I mean, yeah. You just walked us through sort of like a car manual, you know, in terms of how long the characters going. So how much – because I don't ever play World of Warcraft. How much does Blizzard actually teach the player about all of this stuff versus is this just how the game works and you have to figure it out? Because like you'll walk up and you'll see a pedestal that's like – and you hover over it or whatever and it says like insert a keystone. You're like, I don't know what the fuck that is. And you get one later from beating the dungeon. And then you go try it and you see what it is. Like, is that how you learn?
A lot of it is conveyed through things like tooltips and stuff, right? So like you get your keystone and then it's like insert this into a font of power or whatever. And so that when you go into a dungeon and you like there's this thing there and you mouse over it as like font of power.
But then when you see this like netherworld obelisk, are you just like, what is this? And you go into it and that's how you find out.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of that stuff is just kind of discovered through trial and error or through like more sophisticated players who check out the patch notes and they figure out what they're supposed to do. Okay. And then they teach the rest of it.
Even stuff like the fact that you kill the nether enemies in the nether world and other, if you don't, that they actually come up, you know, later, right?
Yeah. I mean, people found that out the hard way.
It's the kind of connection that like your average person is not going to make, because they would actually have to experience it multiple times, multiple ways.
But they probably would. Like, it's the fun thing about it is like games like this that push this sense of mastery over the world are just like, they're so fun. Cause once you know that, then you're like, oh, we can use this, you know, to our advantage, which is funny.
It requires that like really high meta level community discovery and discussion. Mm-hmm.
This is also why it's bracketed, right? So like when you do the dungeon normally, it's simple and very familiar in terms of the kinds of things that you see. And as you get higher and higher level keys, then
stuff gets crazier.
The new things start to happen.
Yeah, there's a concept of fog of war in like RTSs and stuff, which basically just means that you can't see further than you have explored. But there's always sort of a buffer range. Like you have a line of sight that's sort of much further than your character. You can actually kind of – you can basically pierce the fog to a degree.
Yeah.
But or there's another one.
Satellite dish in a
– Yeah, right, to reveal something.
Craft, well. You know. Yeah.
yeah. But there's this other one, which I remember from playing League of Legends a bunch, which we would refer to as face checking, which sounds similar. So there's a question of like which style of information gain are you using? So Fog of War is like you can see a bit of the ways off. You can't see the whole thing, but you know you got some pre-warning. Face checking was where you would have to walk into a bush and you can't see in the bush before you're right, standing you're in it.
Yeah.
And so it was always one of those things where it was like if someone starts walking toward a bush, you're like, don't face check it. Like shoot something in there, see if something gets in there, don't face check it. But it is actually fun to have a mix of those kinds of mechanics, right? Because they have a sort of information release as a mechanic, right? Is a fun part
yeah.
of
the well, it's an interesting thing, though. It's the idea of opaqueness that you know is there, right? Or that you can understand as a player that there's some hidden information here that you could figure out, right? And I think that's kind Taking of an interesting risk. Sort of – it's an interesting risk from a development and design side of putting these things in that are not – clearly linked or that take a lot of effort or multiple trials for somebody to discover a pattern because that's where like all this really interesting depth comes from. But yep. That's also carries this huge risk that players who experience that can't figure out what is – so it has to somehow be like still good.
Well, what
even
you need to
understanding the meta content.
100%. Yeah, what you need to do as a developer in a multiplayer context like that is you need to give people a springboard. So like give them enough information that they can begin down the path and then they can figure it out together, either just in that group or as a community.
That's true. I mean the discovering stuff together is actually so fun, right? Because if you and your buddy both are like, all right, we're going to open this door and you can't see beyond it. But like we're here right now, we're going to do it. And then you rip it open and then you know, zombies pour out or something.
That's the beauty of video games is like they encourage experimentation and making mistakes. So like you're like, I don't know what's going to happen. You open the door and you're like, well, that was a bad idea. Next time, we all died. So next time, let's not do that.
Yep.
So those are our games of choice. Terraria. Wow. all right, Captain Jazz says, in that other platformer,
I don't know what you're talking about.
There are three bro baddies, Hammer Bro, Fire Bro, and Boomerang Bro. You all are also three bros. Who among the three of you would you say is most like each of these bros?
Mm.
Hammer Bro, Fire Bro, and Boomerang Bro.
I don't know enough about their personalities.
I don't think they have any because they're Mario characters. Not throw shade. they're just
coops. Shots fired.
They're turtles that throw various things. So
I think given that burn that Sam just laid down, he'd have to be the fire bro.
Ooh.
That's true.
Sick.
I'd say I'd be the hammer bro because I have one tool and everything that I go after is a nail.
That is true.
I think in that same way, then probably Adam ends up being the boomerang bro. You know?
Yeah, he's got a bit more finesse.
Because if I don't want something and try to throw it away, it just comes back anyway.
Right. You thought you were done with this problem, and it just – there it
done,
is.
But it's back.
There it is again.
Adam made our art deployment pipeline, but it just keeps coming back and has to catch up over and over again.
That's the problem when you make tools for other people.
Goddamn.
Yeah. Can't be left alone.
That's very funny. I like this.
Speaking of hammering things, I want to talk about something really fun, which is – all right. In Levelhead, we have the marketing department. You publish your level, and once enough people have played it, it graduates. It moves to the tower. And right now, in early access, it takes 40 players to graduate your level. And we've been bumping up against this question over and over again, which is, when we launch this game, how many people should it take? Should it be 1,000? Should it be 2,000? Should it stay at 40? And so we were talking about it last week and we decided to try a flexible marketing department. So like the number of players would change depending on
what's going on in the
This is where Seth's economic background comes in handy.
Yeah. And so we were like, we can use exposure bucks as a equilibrium price point and balance the marketing department around a certain exposure bucks median and stuff. So we tried all these things.
Very fancy.
But when I say we tried them, I mean after talking to Adam was like, honestly, just make a simulation because we have no idea. We have no idea like what is right and what's wrong. And so if we can create a simulation that is based on our reasonable expectation of player behavior, then we can create scenarios where you have different levels of player activity, 10 concurrent players, 10,000 concurrent players, whatever. And then we could just look at the marketing department in the simulation and see what it does. Like, what is it doing in response to all these players? How fast are levels graduating? How many exposure bucks are there in the marketing department? All that stuff. And so I used my hammer, which is GameMaker, to create a simulated ecosystem of the marketing department. Should I say what the conclusion is? What we're going to do?
I don't see why not. Also, like it would be very disappointing if we didn't.
Yeah. I thought this was going somewhere with a conclusion.
So all we have to do, we think, is change the required players to 100.
Yeah.
That's it.
And the cool part is that actually kind of works at any scale, except for when the scale is very small like it is right now, because it would just take too long currently.
Our decision metric was basically to say, like, we want you to get enough players, guaranteed players on your level that it feels good, that you're getting a good number of players. But if as that number goes up, as the requirement goes up, it just levels sit longer. And the longer they sit, the more exposure bucks they accrue, which means that it gets harder and harder to move your level up to the top, right? So the
– it needs to always feel reasonably feasible to graduate your level.
Yes. Yeah. And there's another problem, which is if the requirement goes too low, then we end up with levels graduating from the marketing department essentially as fast as they get created, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's weird, right? Like you publish one and you would put like 50 exposure bucks in it and then it gets 10 players and graduates. Like that's it's just too fast and not satisfying. Mm-hmm. So we have to kind of find that balance and where we think – it's going to go is just 100 players has like a really nice balance between how much you play other people's levels, how many exposure bucks you need, and how many players you get.
Yeah. And the cool thing is that it is sort of scale independent in that it comes out of a ratio, right? It's like what – how many – so for every new player that introduces a level into the marketing department, how many other people are playing levels, right? And it's just a ratio. If we get – 10 times as many players, we also have 10 times as many levels being made, right?
Yep.
And so that number
really dictates – So it works at all scales.
Yeah, so it all scales together. And what that number does is just really dictate basically how much effort is required on your part to get your levels up in front of people. Because even as it stands right now with like the current marketing department, we could in principle set that to 100 because we have enough players coming in and out over time that would happen, right? It's just that it would just take a long fucking time as it stands right now. Yeah,
and those levels would just – their exposure bucks would just keep creeping up. I think a good example is there's a couple of multiplayer levels in the marketing department that just don't get played much because multiplayer is a much, much smaller fraction. And they have like 100,000 exposure bucks.
Yeah.
Because they just sit there.
So if you have two players, does that count as two? That just counts as one, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So we got some issues we got to work on with that side of things. But so it was a fun, interesting thing, but I got to use my hammer to simulate it and figure out what it was.
Good job, Harry.
One final quick question from Beaky Bapa Boop. Have you ever had a piece of code that you just couldn't get to work, so you scrapped it all and did something different? I wouldn't say.
Probably.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say
it's more of a strategy that I couldn't get to work. Yeah, actually, it's not that I couldn't get to work; it's that I discovered it was a bad strategy. I think.
I mean, this happens with art stuff too, right? You'll make a picture, and I've talked to Adam and Seth about this as well as maybe a little bit on podcast. But sometimes you're working on it, and you're like, for some reason, this is harder than I thought it was going to be, and then it should, like, getting this particular thing to work. So yeah, you just like burn it down and try something else. It should be pretty easy once you get there. The difficulty actually should be in finding out the correct strategy to implement.
Yeah.
The implementation.
It's a fog of war problem.
Yeah. The only times I've had code that I just literally couldn't get to work that I needed to get to work was when it depended on somebody else's code and for which there was too little documentation or other information. So, SDKs, third-party libraries, all this kind of stuff where you just – your only move is to guess, and sometimes guesses are impossible. So if, for example, a thing that we're dealing with right now, which I won't go into details or name names, if, for example, somebody updates something and then doesn't also update the documentation, and then if also the thing that got updated is a URL that is not one you can predict.
Yep.
Right? Mm. Then there's literally no move for you.
You can't infer what it's
supposed to be. Yeah. There is no move for you except to hit customer support and wait for somebody to update the documentation. Mm-hmm. So those are the kinds of things that I do run into because I have to work with third-party code so often doing all the web stuff. And that I know Sure runs into
at
probably an even worse level because not only is he working with third-party documentation, but in my case, it's basically all web stuff at least, right? In his case, it's like – it's SDKs, it's back-end stuff, trying to figure out how to get, the platform things to work, it's localization things, it's like a million things, and each one has some opaqueness to it, and some of it is not guessable.
Yep. Yeah, I think that's fair. It's not giving up to start working on a thing and say, this was a terrible idea, I need to do this differently, or abandon it because it doesn't actually – it turned out to be like more expensive than it needed to be, like Sam was saying.
Yeah, I've been.
This is way harder than it's supposed to be. That's just moving forward in a biased random walk.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I think. All right. Now, that's all the time we have for this week. We'd like to thank our producers, Fat Bard and Jen Koster, for putting the podcast together. And thanks to our community moderators who keep our Discord running. To get more involved with the Butterscotch community, go to podcast.bscotch.net where we have links to everything.
Thank you. While you're there, you should go pre-order Levelhead. You can do it on all kinds of stuff.
At podcast.bscotch.net. I mean,
there's a link up at the top that says games right there. It's all there.
Oh, yeah.
Get in there. Find all the links. Pre-order down everything.
Stitch your accounts together. Pre-order the game.
Get ready.
Get ready.
Do it all.
It's coming. All right. Thank you all for listening. We'll see you next week.
Goodbye.
Bye. Bye.